They consign all Atreides to the left hand of the damned, to the woman's sun which is full of burning."
Jessica allowed herself a shudder. Idaho undoubtedly had delivered those words with the same voice in which he'd heard the original curse. Why did he expose this to House Carino? She could picture an outraged Fremen, terrible in his anger, standing before his tribe to vent that ancient curse. Why did Idaho want Faradin to hear it?
"You make a strong argument for the marriage of Ganima and Faradin," she said.
"You always did have a single-minded approach to problems," he said. "Ganima's Fremen. She can marry only one who pays no fai, no tax for protection. House Carino gave up its entire Chome holdings to your son and his heirs. Faradin exists on Atreides' sufferance. And remember, when your duke planted the hawk flag on Arrakis, remember what he said. Here I am, here I remain. His bones are still there, and Faradin would have to live on Arrakis, his Sardaukar with him."
Idaho shook his head at the very thought of such an alliance.
"There's an old saying that one peels a problem like an onion," she said, her voice cold. "How dare he patronize me? Unless he's performing for Faradin's watchful eyes.
Somehow I can't see Fremen and Sardaukar sharing a planet," Idaho said. "That's a layer which doesn't come off the onion."
She didn't like the thoughts which Idaho's words might arouse in Faradin and his advisers, spoke sharply.
"House Atreides is still the law in this empire." And she thought, "Does Idaho want Faradin to believe he can regain the throne without the Atreides?"
"Oh, yes," Idaho said. "I almost forgot. Atreides' law, as translated, of course, by the priests of the Golden Elixir. I have but to close my eyes, and I hear your duke telling me that real estate is always gained and held by violence or the threat of it. Fortune passes everywhere, as Gurney used to sing it. The end justifies the means? Or do I have my proverbs mixed up? Well, it doesn't matter whether the mailed fist is brandished openly by Fremen legions or Sardaukar, or whether it's hidden in the Atreides' law. The fist is still there, and the onion layer won't come off, my lady. You know, I wonder which fist Faradin will demand."
"What is he doing?" Jessica wondered.
House Carino would soak up this argument and gloat over it.
"So you think the priests wouldn't let Ganima marry Faradin?"
Jessica ventured, probing to see where Idaho's words might be leading.
"Let her? Gods below! The priest will let Alia do whatever she decrees. She could marry Faradin herself."
"Is that where he's fishing?"
Jessica wondered.
"No, my lady," Idaho said. "That's not the issue. This empire's people cannot distinguish between Atreides' government and the government of Beast Raban. Men die every day in Arrakeen's dungeons. I left because I could not give my sword arm another hour to the Atreides. Don't you understand what I'm saying? Why I came here to you as the nearest Atreides representative? The Atreides Empire has betrayed your duke and your son. I loved your daughter, but she went one way and I went another. If it comes down to it, I'll advise Faradin to accept Ganima's hand, or Alia's, only on his own terms."
"Ah, he sets the stage for a formal withdrawal with honor from Atreides' service," she thought.
But these other matters of which he spoke, could he possibly know how well they did her work for her? She scowled at him.
"You know spies are listening to every word, don't you?"
"Spies?"
He chuckled.
"They listen as I would listen in their place. Don't you know how my loyalties move in a different way? Many's the night I've spent alone in the desert, and the Fremen are right about that place. In the desert, especially at night, you encounter the dangers of hard thinking."
"Is that where you heard Fremen curse us?"
"Yes, among the Al-Aruba. At the preacher's bidding I joined them, my lady. We call ourselves the Zar Sadus, those who refuse to submit to the priests. I am here to make formal announcement to an Atreides that I have removed myself to enemy territory."
Jessica studied him, looking for betrayals of minutiae, but Idaho gave no indication that he spoke falsely or with hidden plans. Was it really possible that he'd gone over to Faradin? She was reminded of her sisterhood's maxim, "In human affairs, nothing remains enduring. All human affairs revolve in a helix, moving around and out." If Idaho had really left the Atreides' fold, that would explain his present behavior. He was moving around and out. She had to consider this as a possibility.
But why had he emphasized that he did the preacher's bidding?
Jessica's mind raced, and having considered alternatives, she realized she might have to kill Idaho. The plan upon which she had staked her hopes remained so delicate that nothing could be allowed to interfere with it. Nothing. and Idaho's words hinted that he knew her plan. She gauged their relative positions in the room, moving and turning to place herself in position for a lethal blow.
"I've always considered the normalizing effect of the Fawfer, Lucas, to be a pillar of our strength," she said.
Let him wonder why she shifted their conversation to the system of class distinction.
"The Landsrat Council of the Great Houses, the regional Sisselrods, all deserve our—"
"You do not distract me," he said. And Idaho wondered at how transparent her actions had become. Was it that she had grown lax in concealment, or had he finally breached the walls of her Bene Gesserit training? The latter, he decided, but some of it was in herself, a changing as she aged. It saddened him to see the small ways the new Fremen differed from the old. The passing of the desert was the passing of something precious to humans, and he could not describe this thing, no more than he could describe what had happened to the Lady Jessica. Jessica stared at Idaho in open astonishment, not trying to conceal her reaction. Could he read her that easily?
"You will not slay me," he said. He used the Fremen words of warning. "Don't throw your blood upon my knife."
And he thought, "I've become very much the Fremen." It gave him a wry sense of continuity to realize how deeply he had accepted the ways of the planet which had harbored his second life.
"I think you'd better leave," she said.
"Not until you accept my withdrawal from Atreides' service."
"Accepted."
She bit it off, and only after she'd uttered the word did she realize how much pure reflex had gone into this exchange. She needed time to think and reconsider. How had Idaho known what she would do? She did not believe him capable of leaping time in the spice way. Idaho backed away from her until he felt the door behind him. He bowed.
"Once more I call you my lady, and then never again. My advice to Faradin will be to send you back to Wallach, quietly and quickly, at the earliest practical moment. You are too dangerous a toy to keep around. Although I don't believe he thinks of you as a toy, you are working for the Sisterhood, not for the Atreides. I wonder now if you ever worked for the Atreides. You witches move too deeply and darkly for mere mortals ever to trust."
"A Gola considers himself a mere mortal," she jibed.
"Compared to you," he said.
"Leave,"
she ordered.
"Such is my intention."
He slipped out the door, passing the curious stare of the servant who'd obviously been listening.
"It's done," he thought, "and they can read it in only one way."
Only in the realm of mathematics can you understand Muad'Dib's precise view of the future. Thus, first we postulate any number of point dimensions in space. This is the classic n-fold extended aggregate of n dimensions. Within this framework, time, as commonly understood, becomes an aggregate of one-dimensional properties. Applying this to the Muad'Dib phenomenon, we find that we either are confronted by new properties of time, or, by reduction through the infinity calculus, we are dealing with separate systems which contain n-body properties. For Muad'Dib, we assume the latter. As demonstrated by the reduction, the point dimensions of the n-fold can only have separate existence within different frameworks of time. Separate dimensions of time are thus demonstrated to coexist. This being the inescapable case, Muad'Dib's predictions required that he perceive the n-fold not as extended aggregate, but as an operation within a single framework. In effect, he froze his universe into that one framework which was his view of time. Palim Basha, Lectures at Siege Tabor. Leto lay at the crest of a dune, peering across open sand at a sinuous rock outcropping. The rock lay like an immense worm atop the sand, flat and threatening in the morning sunlight. Nothing stirred there. No bird circled overhead. No animal scampered among the rocks. He would see the slots of a wind trap almost at the center of the worm's back. There'd be water here. The rock worm held the familiar appearance of a seat shelter, except for the absence of living things. He lay quietly, blending with sand, watching. One of Gurney Halleck's tunes kept flowing through his mind, monotonously persistent.
"Beneath the hill where the fox runs lightly, a dappled sun shines brightly, where my one love still. Beneath the hill in the fennel brake, I spy my love who cannot wake. He hides in a grave beneath the hill."
Where was the entrance to that place? Leto wondered. He felt the certainty that this must be Jacques Tufandac, but there was something wrong here beyond the lack of animal movement. Something flickered at the edges of conscious perception, warning him. What hid beneath the hill? Lack of animals was bothersome. It aroused his Fremen sense of caution. The absence says more than the presence when it comes to desert survival. But there was a wind trap. There would be water and humans to use it. This was the taboo place which hid behind Fondak's name, its other identity lost even to the memories of most Fremen. And no birds or animals could be seen there. No humans. Yet here the golden path began. His father had once said, "There's unknown all around at every moment. That's where you seek knowledge." Leto glanced out to his right along the dune crests. There'd been a mother storm recently. Lake Azrak, the gypsum plain, had been exposed from beneath its sandy cover. Fremen superstition said that whoever saw the beyond, the white lands, was granted a two-edged wish, a wish that might destroy you. Leto saw only a gypsum plain which told him that open water had existed once here on Arrakis, as it would exist once more. He peered upward, swinging his gaze all around in the search for movement. The sky was porous after the storm. Light passing through it generated a sensation of milky presence, of a silver sun lost somewhere above the dust veil which persisted in the high altitudes. Once more, Leto brought his attention back to the sinuous rock. He slipped the binoculars from his Fremkit, focused their motile lenses, and peered at the naked grayness, this outcropping where once the men of Jakarutu had lived. Amplification revealed a thorn bush, the one called Queen of Night. The bush nestled in shadows of a cleft which might be an entrance into the old siege. He scanned the length of the outcropping. The silver sun turned reds into gray, casting a diffuse flatness over the long expanse of rock. He rolled over, turning his back on Jakarutu, scanned the circle of his surroundings through the binoculars. Nothing in that wilderness preserved the marks of human passage. The wind already had obliterated his tracks, leaving only a vague roundness where he had dropped from his worm in the night. Again he looked at Jakarutu. Except for the wind trap, there was no sign that men had ever passed this way. And without that sinuous length of rock, there was nothing here to subtract from the bleached sand, a wilderness from horizon to horizon. Leto felt suddenly that he was in this place because he had refused to be confined in the system which his ancestors bequeathed him. He thought of how people looked at him, that universal mistake in every glance except Ganyma's. Except for that ragged mob of other memories, this child was never a child. I must accept responsibility for the decision we made, he thought. Once more he scanned the length of rock. By all the descriptions, this had to be Fondak, and no other place could be Jakarutu. He felt a strange, resonant relationship with the taboo of this place. In the Bene Gesserit way, he opened his mind to Jakarutu, seeking to know nothing about it. Knowing was a barrier which prevented learning. For a few moments he allowed himself merely to resonate, making no demands, asking no questions. The problem lay within the lack of animal life, but it was a particular thing which alerted him. He perceived it then. There were no scavenger birds, no eagles, no vultures, no hawks. Even when other life hid, these remained. Every watering place in this desert held its chain of life. At the end of the chain were the omnipresent scavengers. Nothing had come to investigate his presence. How well he knew the watchdogs of the siege, that line of crouched birds on the cliff's edge at Tabor, primitive undertakers waiting for flesh. As the Fremen said, our competitors. But they said it with no sense of jealousy, because questing birds often told when strangers approached. What if this Fondak has been abandoned even by the smugglers? Leto paused to drink from one of his catch tubes. What if there's truly no water here? He reviewed his position. He'd run two worms into the sand getting here, riding them with his flail through the night, leaving them half dead. This was the inner desert where the smuggler's haven was to be found. If life existed here, if it could exist, it would have to be in the presence of water. What if there's no water? What if this isn't Fondak Jakarutu? Once more he aimed his binoculars at the wind trap. Its outer edges were sand-etched, in need of maintenance, but enough of it remained. There should be water. But what if there isn't? An abandoned siege might lose its water to the air, to any number of catastrophes. Why were there no scavenger birds? Killed for their water? By whom? How could all of them be eliminated? Poison? Poisoned water. The legend of Jakarutu contained no story of the cistern poisoned, but it might have been. If the original flocks were slain, would they not have been renewed by this time? The Idwali were wiped out generations ago, and the stories never mentioned poison. Again he examined the rock with his binoculars. How could an entire siege have been wiped out?